What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Today my guest is Julia Boorstin, senior media and tech correspondent for CNBC. Boorstin is no stranger to entertainment industry insiders. She's been CNBC's Hollywood correspondent for years. But during the pandemic, she found time to pursue a passion project, writing a book about female leaders in business. Let me tell you, listeners, this is no breezy read, nor is it dominated by interviews with the usual suspects when it comes to women business leaders. Boorstin did her homework and her research. The book is organized by broad themes that are probed in depth. It's not platitudes about girl bosses. It's deeply reported with facts and figures to back up her assertions that female approaches to running companies are very often good for business. Boorstin has the receipts on how women leaders lead into innovation, sustainability, and have a knack for finding discrete markets where money is being left on the table because others don't see a need or profit potential. And she pulls no punches in calling out the venture capital community for the pitifully small volume of investment dollars that flow into female-led ventures every year. That's all coming up after the break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
thanks for sticking around. We're back now with more on the power of women in leadership from CNBC's Julia Boorstin.
Julia Boorstin, senior media and technology correspondent for CNBC, a face that Hollywood business watchers know well from her terrific reports and crack interviews with top CEOs. Julia Boorstin has written a book called When Women Lead. It is terrific. It is full of scholarship and data. This is not a breezy beach read. It is a deeply reported, really intelligent, and I'm going to underscore intelligent, look at what it means, the impact of women in business, what it means to have female leadership rising slowly, but rising up through the ranks in this country and around the world. It is a book with a truly global focus. I am just absolutely staggered at the research and data that went into it. And I'm going to start with the question that everybody probably asks you. Julia Boorstin, who is on CNBC all the time covering this most dynamic business, how on earth did you find the time to write this deeply reported book?
You know, I was very lucky that during the pandemic, I was safely at home with my family, and I was broadcasting from home. As you know, I've seen you in all sorts of different cities around the country at different conferences and things, but my travel came to a halt, and I set up a little studio in my house, a studio which has since moved several times. But gone were the days on the road. Gone were the afternoons and evenings out at events. I was really locked down, and I had started working on a book proposal before the pandemic started. And once the pandemic hit, I thought, I have this window. I'm at home. I'm not socializing. I'm not out on the road. I need to use this time and get this proposal out and get this book written. And I felt like I had this deadline looming, and I thought, any day now, any week now, the pandemic's gonna be over, so I should really get as much done as I can now. So as a result, I was incredibly efficient. But the beauty for me of this time at home is that everyone was at home, and people who might have been really hard to get interviews with or hard to nail down were available. And I did so many interviews with people when they were walking their dogs, or when they were hiding in their closet trying to get a break from their young children, or when they were cooking dinner. And women just opened up to me, and I spent hours and hours on Zoom and on the phone in people's, it really felt like I was in their homes. And so A, I had a lot more access. B, I think that the conversations ended up being much more intimate and personal, because not only was I in their homes with them at this time, when everyone was kind of going through something together, but also there was this sense that the world stopped and everyone was taking a step back and thinking about their purpose, thinking about why they were doing what they were doing. What was their management strategy? Why did they care about leading in a certain way?
Right.
How do I connect with my employees? What are my goals? And so it was actually a really important moment for these leaders to think about what they were doing, and also for me to connect with them and also see how they were facing the biggest challenges of our time.
What initially inspired you to want to look at this area?
So I've been at CNBC for 16 years. I have the most amazing job. As you know, the media and tech industry has changed so much in that time. Never a dull moment. And I have these two projects that I love at CNBC. One is the Disruptor 50 list. I launched it over 10 years ago, and I wanted to look at the fascinating startups that were transforming business before they go public. CNBC is, of course, focused on public companies, but I had covered Facebook from the time it was relatively young through the IPO, and I thought there is no model for CNBC to look at these private companies long before the IPO. We need to be getting these companies and the types of technologies that they're representing on our viewers' radar early. So I created this list, and as a result, I've had the wonderful job of interviewing a lot of private company CEOs, fascinating innovators over the past 10 years. So on one hand, I was interviewing all these amazing, innovative, tech-driven companies. And on the other hand, I had launched this other project that I love called Closing the Gap. And after the whole Time's Up Me Too movement, I thought, you know, we've told all these negative stories, but we need to be focusing on the solutions. We as a network need to be looking at the companies and individuals who are doing positive work to close gender and diversity gaps. So my colleagues and I created this franchise. It's online and it's on TV. And we told stories of ways that companies like Salesforce or PayPal were closing equity gaps in their pay and in promotion. So I was looking at all these stats about pay equity and all these things. And I kept on coming across these stats that seemed insane to me. And the one in particular that stuck out to me was the fact that, yes, women are now 8% of the Fortune 500. They are maybe 20% of boards, depending on when you cite that stat. But when it comes to venture capital funding, mm-hmm. women over the past decade have gotten 3% on average of all venture capital dollars. And I thought, this is bananas. This is bananas. The most recent stats were that 82% of all venture capital dollars went to companies without a single female co-founder. So that means that all these billions of dollars that are funneling into companies like Uber or Airbnb that are going to change the way we live don't have women involved. So I thought, this is crazy. I was interviewing women who had defied those odds for those female leaders. And I thought, I want to know how these women did it. And I was interviewing them for the Disruptor 50 list. So I thought, these women are by definition exceptional. And so I want to hear their stories and figure out how they did it.
And it just goes the venture capital stat, which is just so like stubborn and annoying, is that like when you, it's so incongruous with knowing as in the U.S. as well as in hugely in other areas, Asia, Africa, where is, you know, more than 50% of the entrepreneurship is coming from women startup funds. So what message does that send? And it's, you know,
yeah. So, I mean, and look, 42% of all small businesses in the United States are run by women. There are clearly plenty of entrepreneurial women, but the fact that women last year, female founded companies got 2% of all VC dollars, that's crazy. And so yet the ones who were doing it and had managed to defy those odds are amazing. So I really sort of use the lens of this area where women have the least representation, because in some ways they are most exceptional. So the book is full of lots of different stories. Mm-hmm. I talk about Sarah Harden and mm-hmm. Reese Witherspoon and Lena Waithe and mm-hmm. some CEOs of nonprofits. But I talk a lot about the tech industry just because the stats are so crazy and the women have to be so amazing to defy those odds.
I mean, going deep into it, and again, the scholarship here is so impressive, is that you go into how that women who frame their pitches for venture capital and private equity funding, if they frame their pitches with a socially conscious lens, they have a better track record of getting money and then setting up a successful business with the kind of capital, which is, you know, it's not bad. Socially conscious is terrific, but it is that it is frustrating because it's like, well, you have to be one thing. You have to be warm and fuzzy. What's not budging there?
Well, what's so interesting, I mean, it's so funny though. So many women I talked to said they founded a company and they would take it to VCs and someone asked them, so who's your white male co-founder going to be? There was one Indian woman and people say, who's your white, you got to get a white male to be your partner.
I don't know how you wouldn't just like turn over some furniture and walk out.
Or give up. I always said, why didn't you give up? That's amazing. There was a bunch of women said that they would pitch their idea and the target audience was women and the VCs would say, I don't know. You know, my wife never had a problem with that. There's this one woman, Shanlin Ma. She's the CEO of a wedding company, or like a wedding registry planning company called Zola. It's incredibly popular. And she pitched her idea with all this data to these VCs. And it was a bunch of men, and they said, I don't know, let's like pull in an assistant in here. There's a woman, let's pull in my assistant. She's a woman, let's get her thought on this. She's like, this is a business. I'm giving you numbers and projections. They said, I don't know, the wedding industry just doesn't seem like that big of a business. Of course, it's a $50 billion business, and now her business is doing great. But so there was just this disconnect between the older white men who were meeting with her and the actual understanding of the market data. So I think to answer your question about why the investors are not adequately understanding the opportunity, a lot of that comes down to the fact that the VC industry has not changed in many years. It's not like Wall Street, which has gone through various reckonings, because those are public companies. They're transparent. They report data. Any company, whether it's a tech giant like Google or Apple, these are companies that are reporting gender and racial diversity data. They put it on their website every year. And every sort of study will tell you that the best way to drive change is to have transparency. Up until about 2017, 2018, there was no measure of the diversity in the Silicon Valley financial institutions. And these are small groups of people who make a couple of big bets a year. And they're hoping
really influence markets.
Really influence markets.
Can influence the price of tomatoes they decide to support something that needs tomato juice, you know?
Well, but it really, I mean, like, there are these crazy examples like SoftBank, which has this 300-year vision fund. It will just pour hundreds of millions of dollars into an idea like an Uber if they think it's a good idea.
See, we crashed.
Or the Uber TV show. So, but there's so much money at play. And there's a lot of really interesting data about how this is not malicious, right? There's a lot of data showing that male investors are half as likely as female investors to invest in a female-led company. So that's really interesting. So statistically, a female investor is twice as likely to invest in a female-led company than a male investor is. The problem there is that women represent a very small percentage of the decision makers at VCs. I think it's something like 13% of decision makers at VCs, and I'm going to have to double check that. But the idea is that women aren't represented in terms of the powerful positions in those venture capital firms. And so therefore, if they're twice as likely to invest in women, then you don't have a lot of female founders getting capital.
Right.
And a lot of that comes down to pattern matching. I want to make it really clear. I'm not pointing fingers. I don't think this is malicious. A lot of data in my book points to the fact that female leaders are sometimes more likely to generate high returns than male leaders. So if people care about making money, they should be investing in female founders. The reason why they're not is because they're looking for someone oftentimes who reminds them of Mark Zuckerberg. Mm-hmm. So many of these investments are made at the early stage before there is a track record, before there's revenue or profitability or anything to show the success of the actual business. So many investors are betting on ideas and founders. Mm-hmm. They're looking for founders who have a track record, and they're looking for founders who remind them of a founder who succeeded in the past. And I have a quote in there of a VC saying he would invest in anyone who reminds him of Mark Zuckerberg. So this is a vicious cycle. It perpetuates itself.
How much does the Elizabeth Holmes thing hurt the cause of women trying to break this logjam?
Look, I loved the Elizabeth Holmes podcast. I love the TV show.
I consumed
show.
It in all forms of media.
I think it's fascinating, and I have to say, just as a consumer of content, I really enjoyed all of the content around it. Having said that, it really is a bummer, for lack of a better way to put it, that when you ask people, like, think of a female CEO in tech, the first person who comes to mind is Elizabeth Holmes. There are billboards of Amanda Seyfried playing Elizabeth Holmes all over LA. That's who people think of. But she is not representative of what female leaders are like.
Especially in tech, because that firm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, she was a total failure.
Right. And it was never a tech firm.
And yeah, I mean, it was an idea. You know, it was a failed idea. But I think that it's very easy to glom onto these archetypes. I mean, you think about Hollywood, like, there are a couple of archetypes. There's the Silicon Valley bro in a hoodie archetype. There's mm-hmm. the man in a suit, Wall Street CEO archetype. Mm-hmm. And they're just, the archetype of a female CEO is an Elizabeth Holmes type. You know, a young white blonde woman who fails. That's like what people have in their head. And it's just not accurate. And also to me, what drives me crazy, and one reason I wanted to tell mm-hmm. the stories of about 60 women in this book, is there was such an amazing diversity, such a wide range of different ways that women are leading, and they look and sound and do things in entirely their own ways. I mean, there are never women in the book who are introverts. They figured out how to use their introversion as a superpower in business. I think that's so cool because it totally breaks the stereotype of what a leader is supposed to be like.
I want to ask you about that. Jotting down things. I want to ask you before we move off of venture capitals, what about hedge funds?
I don't go to hedge funds. They are dealing mostly in public companies, and they're shorting and they're doing long bets. Mm-hmm. But that because they're more regulated because they're dealing with public companies because of the SEC regulations. But it is a different deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is like the venture capital is the power in venture capital is that there's an idea or an entrepreneur they believe in. They can pour in tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars long before a company is profitable. So they can determine whether or not an idea becomes a successful business. And I think it has massive impact on our society if you think about the way tech companies have changed everything.
Yeah, just look at our phones and half of the apps. Let me ask you the opposite of that. Do you find when you talk to especially the female founders, like, is there a scenario where small can be beautiful? Is everybody aiming for the big IPO, or is there a world where you have a nice, I hate to call it a nice little business, but you have a business that is profitable and sustainable, and boy, in some ways that seems like a pretty big home run.
You know, I was just talking to a bunch of women, and some were saying that, you know, a number of female CEOs are wary of taking VC dollars because if you take VC dollars, you might be pushed to grow faster than you feel comfortable with. And you might be pushed to grow faster than is a good idea for your actual business. So I do think, especially because they're dealing with VCs who may not fully understand their vision, there is a little bit more caution around getting into a relationship with someone who's going to pressure you to have a quick outcome or a five-year outcome. I think there are also plenty of women who are incredibly ambitious. They want to create multi-billion dollar companies. They want to be successful. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to do it with an additional purpose. I mean, women are more likely to found purpose-driven companies. So it's not just about generating profits, but also having an environmental impact or helping people, whether it's through health tech or social impact stuff. But I think it's a mix. I think women have also seen how easy it is to get taken down by the media with numerous examples. So I think there is a caution there, but at the same time, they understand that having a public persona can help market your company. So I think it's a big mix of things, but I've seen plenty of women who are incredibly, incredibly ambitious and really want to achieve the same kind of success that men have. And we really haven't seen women at the level of the Jeff Bezoses and Mark Zuckerbergs. We just haven't in terms of the self-made women.
Even more so than like politics, like that seems like the last frontier.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to focus on this field, because it was just such a disparity and such a crazy gender gap.
I thought it also interesting in a common thread through a lot of the interviews and anecdotes was that women, even women founded purpose-driven, you know, kind of socially conscious companies, their first and foremost instinct was there's a market here. There is profits to be made here.
Yeah.
It will, you know, social good is fantastic, But the impetus is not let's do this because it's a good thing to do, but let's do this because there's a market here, there are profits here.
And also there are a lot of industries or areas where people are like, oh, that's philanthropy. Like you want to deal with food waste? Like that's philanthropy. Like that's just garbage. Like maybe it'll help the environment, but you're not going to make money on that. And there's an amazing founder in the book, and she's saying, no, if we can take this food waste and turn it into a profitable business and sell the leftover cauliflower for cauliflower pizza crust or whatever it is, like
and
there's
the
so much demand
juice.
Or the green juice, yeah. You know, a $13 green juice doesn't need to be made with pristine lettuce, you know, pieces of lettuce that you would buy at a grocery store. You can make it with the scraggly stuff that people don't want to eat, but yet would be perfect for a green juice. So this idea that it's actually much better over the long run to take a social or environmental problem and solve it with a sustainable, profitable
exactly.
business, because then you don't have to worry about the winds of change blowing philanthropy dollars somewhere else.
The book, I love these stories. The book is full of that spark of inspiration. I was standing in line at the supermarket. I was stuck in traffic. I was like that spark of inspiration. I was like, when I talk to entrepreneurs, I always try to, what was that spark? What was that spark? I want to talk a little bit more about Hollywood stuff, but in the very 30,000 foot view, I think one thing in reading the book, there's different examples. There's, you know, as women especially started in the 70s and 80s really going into business, there seems to have always been kind of a debate in that, like, do you make the argument that women are as capable as any male CEO can handle? There's nothing, you know, that there is no difference in anything else is gender bias. Or is there an argument to be made that women do lead differently and we should respect and appreciate what different leadership styles bring to any sector? I don't know. And I know it doesn't have to be black or white.
I don't think they're either or. I think they're both. I think they're both and. I think that it's been interesting, like, looking at the data about leading and managing in crisis. Women have amazing performance managing in crisis, especially if you think about the financial crisis, managing through the pandemic, and in some ways they're leading very differently than male CEOs, but in other ways maybe male CEOs are trying to emulate them, particularly in times of crisis when, say, things like empathy matter more both to employees and customers. So I think that the overwhelming thing that struck me in interviewing hundreds of people and reading all these academic studies is that while we may have a couple of ideas of what leadership looks like or what good leadership looks like, in fact, there are many different skills that can be used for good leadership. And the leaders who were most successful were those who didn't try to force themselves into this box or this stereotype or try to fit a model of what leadership looked like in the 70s, but instead were saying, here's what I'm really good at. And here's how I could hire people around me to fill in the things that I know nothing about. And here's how I can lean into the things that I'm really good at, whether it's being an amazing listener and able to negotiate deals better because you're an introvert, or leading with gratitude and using that gratitude to focus on long-term results, or bringing in perspectives from across your team or across your company, like that kind of communal bringing everyone together leadership. The people who were able to figure out their skill set and lean into it were the ones who I saw able to make the most progress and also feel good about the way they were managing their company. I think for so long people have, and I talked to women about this, they felt like they had to wear the boxy suit and act in a certain way with the shoulder pads. Shoulder pads are back, it's okay. But felt like they had to force themselves to act a certain way. And now
out-guy the guys sometimes.
And now that there are more women in the room, I think that everyone should be able to lead in a way that they feel is more authentic to them.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more from CNBC's Julia Boorstin after this pause for monetization.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
And we're back with more from CNBC's Julia Boorstin on her new book, When Women Lead.
You've been a business reporter for a long time. I know you knew a lot of this intuitively, but what really surprised you from your reporting?
I hadn't read academic research like this in a really long time. And I ended up going down so many rabbit holes about good leadership, about female leadership. And I just read, literally 300 studies. And it was so interesting to look at the fact that social scientists are studying everything from how, when you use humor in the workplace, women are judged more harshly to the fact that like athletes are more successful as CEOs and why is that? So just, there's a lot of interesting mm-hmm. stuff in there. But to the point of Hollywood, since you cover Hollywood, there was some amazing data about the power of Hollywood to create archetypes. And I was blown away by the studies, and there's some great stuff out of the Gina Davis Institute, just about mm-hmm. gender gaps in Hollywood. But also the one thing that I keep on thinking about as I show movies to my kids, because we show them a lot of movies from when I was growing up, from the 80s. There were a bunch of movies in the early 80s that made the heroes these young, white, geeky men. And they were techie, and they were solving problems with technology, and the women were just their sidekicks. Whether it was weird science or war games. And these movies, which were great, I rewatched a bunch of them with my family when I was writing this book. They were great, but they really didn't have women in that tech world. And there was this amazing correlation between the rise of this new type of hero in Hollywood.
And set the image.
Set the image.
Pop culture image of the tech geek really was. I was about 14 when War Games came out, so I was the absolute target. Yeah. And the message couldn't have been clearer.
Yeah.
This is a guy's
tech game. Is a guy's game. The girl is there to go on the adventure, but she can't help with the technology stuff. So there were all of these movies that came out, and over the next 20 years, there was a 20 percentage point decline in the number of women who enrolled in computer science as their major in college. Now, obviously, there were a lot of other things that were going on as well, but the cultural archetype was that tech was a young guy's game. And the fact that there were all these women who majored in computer science before that era is crazy to me. It started to come up. That curve has definitely started to change. But I think that it really reminded me how powerful Hollywood is. And look, my husband works in Hollywood. I live here in LA. I cover these companies, But that's why I think the work of companies like Hello Sunshine mm-hmm. or Lena Waithe with Hillman Grad, both of which I wrote about in my book, I think they're so important, because just like the tech companies are powerful, the Hollywood entertainment companies are powerful, because those are stereotypes and archetypes that are exported around the world.
It is, it's, you know, some have called it soft power, and it is fascinating. And I think it is, as much as the ICBMs, that's what helped win the Cold War. 100%. Blue Jeans and yeah. Elvis Presley yeah. and the Beatles and Madonna, and you know, it just, I really do think that it was that.
And that's why Hollywood culture. And pop culture can be used for a force of good as well. I mean, and you think about, you know, I think about Black Panther and Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel, and the fact that now my kids have all these action heroes who mm-hmm. are women, and they're not just dressed in miniskirts like they were when I started trying to buy them for them, you know, a decade ago, because I think Hollywood understands that the audience is not just young white men, which was, you know, that's not all they should be marketing towards. And so we're really seeing, a shift in some of the imagery that's getting out there.
Well, yet again, in a business context, you're leaving money on the table.
Exactly.
And I think that there's been a dawning realization there.
Yeah, making movies like Black Panther or Wonder Woman are not philanthropy. It's because there's a huge financial opportunity.
What specific, because you said you spoke with Lena Waithe and Hillman Grad, where she's been doing some really yeah. interesting, and they are dogged over there.
Yeah.
Same thing with Hello Sunshine. Very impactful company doing a lot. Incredibly impressive CEO and Sarah Harden. Tell me anything specifically about entrepreneurship or about the specific challenges of Hollywood and content stand out to you.
What I think is so important, and I talked to Sarah Harden and Reese Witherspoon about this, is this idea of authentic authorship. If the studios are all run by white men, they're not going to understand the vast majority of their audience. And I think that's why we've seen the studios become far more diverse in their leadership. We have people like Donna Langley running Universal, but also their investments in a diverse assortment of filmmakers, because it works. And so what's so interesting is, you know, you see Hello Sunshine, they're saying, what are the shows that we would want to see? And what are who are the filmmakers that can adequately tell those stories? They talked about how when they were making Little Fires Everywhere, they're like, what should the writer's room look like? It should look like the people in the show and the characters in the show and represent those stories. And look, it worked out really well for them. They had that big exit to Candle Media, that Hello Sunshine sale to Candle Media, because they're all about figuring out how to pair mm-hmm. the content creators with a hungry mm-hmm. audience.
At a very high valuation.
At a very high valuation.
A $900 million valuation. And we can talk about, like, there was a lot of industry debate about that valuation.
Yeah.
If that had been, you know, if it had been Ronald Witherspoon as opposed to Reese, would we have had the same level of valuation?
Maybe Ronald Witherspoon has been making great deals for a long time now. So,
But
it's a debate. And look, and Reese Witherspoon is a huge star. But I think, you know, what's been amazing about watching Hello Sunshine is there was this period where all of these streaming services launched. Do you remember that? There was like an Apple TV. You were probably there at these events. I remember going to the Apple TV announcement, and there was a Hulu announcement. And every one of these announcements seemed to feature a show from Hello Sunshine. And so I think that these the streamers were figuring out how to leverage the Hello Sunshine brand, while Hello Sunshine was figuring out how to leverage the streamers to boost their valuation. But I think I was just really impressed by this idea of the importance of them having financial success is that it shows that women can do this, and it shows that it could be done. And Lena Waithe, I think, takes this idea of authentic authorship to the next level, and she tells very specific stories and shows the universal appeal of very specific stories. When I interviewed her, she was telling me that, I don't know if you remember Master of None,
mm-hmm,
she did that very famous Thanksgiving episode mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. she tells a story of her coming out to her family and that experience over Thanksgiving dinner. And that is a very specific experience. But she said that people all over the country would come up to her and say, that was the most amazing episode. It reminded me so much of my family. She said these straight white dudes would come up to her and say, I related so much to that episode. But the way she thinks about it is that was so specific that in a way, there's something about the specificity that people can relate to. If you just had a generic Thanksgiving dinner with families fighting or not talking to each other, whatever it is, it wouldn't feel as real. But the specificity makes it feel real. And also, I think she's really proven that you can take something which may seem like a niche story and show that niche stories have universal appeal, and people want to connect with content that feels real and different than the same stuff they've been watching.
My last question for you, and I love to ask people this question. What was your process for writing? So you've done all your research and I know the feeling of like, you know that you're looking at deadlines and you're looking at, you know, blank files or pages. Did you write at the computer? Did you write longhand? Did you write late at night like many working moms do?
You know those really giant like post-it notes that are 3 feet tall? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like those big GM,
like sometimes they have 3M.
Sticky post-it notes. So I would do all the interviews. I would automatically transcribe them using Otter, which is an amazing app. Mm-hmm. And after each interview, I would go through and re-listen to it. I would take notes on the themes. And then I would take these giant post-it notes. I have these giant poster boards all around our house. And I would write down like what category these women's characteristics filled into.
It's very smartly organized in not a company by company format, but theme and focus. And it's really good reading.
So I would have all of these giant posters basically all over the house with different names and themes. And I would like run around like a crazy person writing in Sharpie on these giant poster boards.
You're Carrie Matheson.
And so exactly. So that's how I would organize the ideas. And then I would sometimes just sit down and just write someone's story, going back to the transcript, and just like, I found the story so amazing. Sometimes I would cry when I was interviewing people. The stories are so inspiring. And in the depths of the pandemic, to get to talk to these women, that's why I love doing this, is because I was so inspired, and it makes you feel so hopeful about the world that there are leaders like this that are trying to fix problems. So I would sometimes just sit down and write. But the truth is that because I wake up very early for work, on the weekends, I would try to wake up at the same time. And I'd wake up at 5 and I would just write for like 4 hours before my family would bother me. And I would just lock myself away. And without the interruptions of anyone, you could really get a lot done. So I thought it was really fun. I really want to write another book.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from listeners. Please go to Variety.com and sign up for our free Strictly Business newsletter. And don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.